welcome you to a lecture today by Professor James Huffman, who is a dean at Northwestern Law School at Lewis and Clark College. Professor Huffman received his JD from University of Chicago and has since then worked in a number of different capacities in a number of different organizations. And he's a specialist when it comes to environmental law, separation of powers, on which he will talk today, and law school issues. The topic that Dean Huffman will talk about today is judicial activism and the role of the judiciary. And it behooves us to talk a little, to know a little about judicial activism before he speaks, in the sense that this term has been used for judges that who existed and rendered opinions for a long, long time. Judge Robert Bork, in his really good book, a landmark book, The Tempting of America, notes that Chief Justice John Marshall was an avid judicial activist. There are other judges, there are other academics as well, who believe that judicial activism is a thing we should encourage from the law and economics perspective. It's much more efficient. So even in the conservative wing, there are two thoughts to whether or not judicial activism should be there. One is, it has been around for a long, long time, so perhaps there was some original intent that supports judicial activism. Other view is, perhaps under the law and economics view, it should be encouraged. Judge Posner is one of the leading proponents of that. I believe to disagree with that and tell us why, Dean Huffman, I present to you, Dean Huffman.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. As a Westerner, it's always good to come visit a real city once in a while. I don't know how many of you have ever been to Portland, Oregon, but it's a nice place, but it lacks a lot of the amenities and I suppose a lot of the problems a city like New York has. I guess by way of starting, let me just summarize where I stand on the issue that has just been outlined for you, and then sort of back up and tell you how I get to that, and I'll leave plenty of time if anybody wants to disagree or ask any questions. I think that the whole way that the judicial activism and judicial restraint debate has proceeded over the last many years has tended to be a liberal-conservative split. That is, the conservative, usually represented by Republicans in Congress, and it usually arises in the context of federal judicial appointments. That's the context in which we most often think of it. He's mentioned Judge Bork. That was probably one of the most memorable occasions where this issue got debated with significant consequence. But it's sort of a background issue at all times, and it's been a background issue with the Clinton nominees, that the Republicans in Congress have been resisting affirming many of Clinton's nominees have been really based it on the claim that these are judicial activists. But if you look at what either the President Clinton or anybody who might have been fallen into the liberal division, if you view the world this way, none of them really claim to be judicial activists. It's really rare anybody says they're for judicial activism. And so I think it's useful to accept, certainly as a pragmatic matter, a lot of economics people effectively do that by arguing that judges ought to decide cases on the basis of efficiency and maximizing net social welfare. And often that means they have to change existing rules of law and alter them in some way. But let me start by just saying how I view this division, and that is, an activist judge, and as I will use the term, is one who is aggressive in enforcing the existing rules of the Constitution, and particularly those relating to individual liberty. So if taking that as the beginning point, I'm for judicial activism if it means that the courts are enforcing the liberties that exist under the American Constitution. Inappropriate judicial activism, in my frame of thinking, is And it is those circumstances in which courts essentially override the legitimate exercise of legislative and administrative functions. So I sort of divide the Constitution in separation of powers terms between liberty protections on the one hand, where I will argue that the courts ought to be aggressively protective of liberty, and therefore not deferential to the legislature or the administration in those cases, as opposed to those areas of legislative and executive power of the government, legitimately defined, and that's an issue we can have a lot of discussion about, what is the legitimate scope of the legislative power and the executive power. Within that realm, I will argue that the courts ought to be very restrained and deferential. Now let me explain how I get there and then see if you find it persuasive or not. It seems to me it's first of all useful to think about what judges do in the abstract and not just judges in our federal system. And at least in this country, I think we have to think about judges in the abstract in the common law system. That is, what is the role of the judge in the common law tradition? And I see the judge in the common law tradition as one whose task is really to interpret pre-existing case law, consistent with the principles of precedent, and more recently, certainly in the last, most of the last century in this country, interpret legislation and regulations. Although that wasn't clearly a traditional common law function of the court, the tools that the common law judges developed in interpreting case law are really the same tools that they use in interpreting statutes and regulations. And the challenge, whether you're interpreting a pre-existing decision of the court or a legislative provision or an administrative rule, is that they will never answer every question that might come up. And that's sort of a transparently obvious point, but one that suggests that they will always have to be filling the gaps. That is, we can never foresee all the prospective developments, and so we can't write a rule, even if we wanted to, that would resolve every future possibility. We can't know the future, so we can't write the rule, nor do we have the capacity of language to do that. There's always going to be vagaries of language where we don't fully understand each other. Even parties to a contract who may think there's a meeting of the minds will, on occasion, not, it will turn out their minds won't have met, or at least it won't be expressed in the language that they've used in the contract, and it may fall to the court later to interpret that. So there's this gap-filling function that courts have to do. That is really the interpretive function, and that's true of interpreting cases, interpreting statutes, interpreting regulations. And what does the judge do when they face that? Well, there are those, and it's been a fairly vociferous group who've argued in recent years that at least with respect to legislation, regulations, constitutions, one should just take the letter of the law, do what the legal rule says is to be done. But as I've already said, the legal rule will inevitably not answer every question. It will always have these gaps or these vague uses of language. And so the judge inevitably has to fill those gaps. And how does the judge do that? Well, I think the only way that the judge can do that in a system of a rule of law, which is what I take to be the basic foundational principle of Anglo-American jurisprudence and the American constitutional system, that is the rule of law as opposed to the rule of persons, the only way they can do that, I think, is with some reference to the intent of whoever wrote the rule in question. Now, sometimes when we talk about, usually questions of frame or intent arise when we're talking about constitutional issues on which people have strong feelings. So let me address that in the context of, let's say, a contract. And I think you can do a contract in some ways. It's very much like a statute or a constitution. It's an attempt to control the future. We enter into a contract for me to purchase your automobile, you're trying to make sure I pay up, and I'm trying to make sure that you deliver the car, and there may be some other things we're trying to make sure happen, but it's really trying to make sure that something that happens in the future, we can decide today how it's going to happen and rely on it happening that way. I think the Constitution serves the same sort of function. So if we're interpreting a contract, which is not something we usually get very emotional about, we want it interpreted with respect to the intent of the framers of that contract. I mean, that's our best reference point. We certainly don't want the judge to to say, I don't care what the people who entered into this contract intended. I'll just do what I think is good for society. At least I don't want judges doing that. I want judges seeing that this contract is interpreted and applied the way the people who entered into it wanted it interpreted. It was, after all, their agreement. They voluntarily entered into it. So I think it's essential in any interpretive function where the court is filling this gap that it be done with reference to the intention of those who wrote whatever the agreement is or the constitutional principle or statutory language is. I don't think you can escape framer intent in a rule of law system, because once you abandon framer intent, you have to have reference to something else. And whatever else that will be, it won't be something that will have adequately provided a guide for those people who were relying on the contract or the Constitution or the statute. But of course, that leads me in the constitutional setting, which is the setting in which we usually think about these questions, to say we have to rely on framer intent. Now, it's not an easy thing to determine, because we know that in the case of the Constitution, we really can't extract some kernel of what the framer intent was. There were, just taking the Constitutional Convention, 55 people there, so they had 55 different ideas, presumably, what any piece of language meant. But I think we can fairly assume that they had some level of agreement about that and common understanding, and that's what we ought to be in search of. Interpreting the Constitution is even more complicated than that, though. As James Madison told us, it isn't really the intent of the people who attended the Convention of Philadelphia that matters. It's the intent of the people who ratified the Constitution at the state conventions that matters, because they were, as he pointed out, after all, those whose ratification of that document made it the Constitution of the United States. So I'm not going to argue that finding framer intent is a simple matter. It's very difficult. There will inevitably be disagreement. But it seems to me if you're committed to the principle of the rule of law, you cannot abandon framer intent as the guiding principle, notwithstanding the difficulties of its determination. Okay, so that's sort of just thinking about what judges do in the abstract. I think they fill these gaps, and they do it with respect. If they're committed to the rule of law, they do it with respect to framer intent. Now, if we're talking about federal judges, which is the context in which this issue most often gets debated, then, of course, we have some other guidelines about what it is judges do, most notably, of course, the Constitution. Now, let me just remind you of at least a few aspects of the Constitution that help define the judicial role. One, of course, is separation of powers. Now, well, if you haven't yet, you will study constitutional law, and you'll know, or will come to know, that the Constitution says nothing about separation of powers. We take that as a structural conclusion from the fact that we have these three articles that lay out the legislative, judicial, and executive functions, and a fair amount of contemporaneous writing that spoke to the concept of separation of powers as a control on the power of government to avoid its abuse. And within that separation of powers, what is it that the framers had in mind about the judicial role? Well, I think they had largely in mind what I've already talked about. That is, their history was of what is it that common law judges do. They had a conception of what the judiciary does. Article 3 doesn't say a whole lot, and most of what it says is sort of about the organization of the courts and more precisely the extent of the jurisdiction, but it's very brief. It doesn't lay out in any great detail what the judicial function is to be. I think it's fair and accurate to say that what they assumed was it was going to be the function that judges played in the common law system. It was this gap-filling function, and it was a commitment to the rule of law as opposed to the rule of the judge or of anybody else who might intervene in the rule of law. So in separation of powers, theoretical terms, I think that's what one has to view as the role of the judiciary. Secondly, the Constitution in Article 3 defines the jurisdiction of the federal courts with some precision, and it's defines both the appellate, original jurisdiction of the Supreme Court, subject matter jurisdiction, and so forth. And pursuant to that, whether it's consistent with the Constitution or not, it's a nice question for a discussion on judicial activism. They've created a lot of justiciability standards, whether there's standing, whether there's there ought to be deference to the states, whether there should be abstention because of that deference to the states, and so forth. But all of that, from a constitutional point of view, ought to derive from the definition of what the function of the courts is. But there's more than Article 3 that says what courts do, I think. Or at least the courts in the federal system ought to be limited by more than just Article 3's definition. It ought to be defined by the provisions of the rest of the Constitution. And let me just suggest a couple of ways in which I think the courts have misinterpreted the historical intent, at least, of the Constitution, and in some sense has really gotten us into this sort of ongoing debate about judicial activism. The federal government, as I read the Constitution, is one of enumerated powers. That's what Article 1, Section 8 is supposed to be, is an enumeration of those powers of the federal government. It'd be a little point going to the trouble of enumerating those powers if they had intended that the courts or that the federal government had a much more expansive scope of legislative power. Well, I think for those of you who've studied constitutional law, with the exception of the Lopez case a couple of years ago, one would have to say that the enumerated powers of the federal government are sort of a dead letter. They don't really constrain the scope of federal power. Congress has seen fit, and it has been endorsed by the Supreme Court, beginning largely with the New Deal era, to say that virtually anything is free game for federal regulation because it affects interstate commerce in one way or another. Lopez counters that, but whether Lopez is an aberration or an indication of something to come, we'll only have to wait and see. We haven't seen much come, at least since Lopez. Well, once you abandon the enumerated powers concept, then you have the Congress doing all manner of other things, which is outside or seemingly outside those enumerated powers, which means that the courts are going to receive this whole influx of cases that arise under this greatly expanded, as I see it, federal power. And that further complicates the role of the courts. And I'd also suggest that the federal structure is another constraint that was intended by the framers to limit the powers of the federal government and has sort of been companion with the abandonment of the enumerated powers provision has meant that the powers of the states have dwindled dramatically along with the powers of local government and expanded in the hands of the federal government. Those are both, I raise both the separation of powers issue and the federalism issue because I think they're ultimately very central to my ultimate conclusion about the importance of liberty and the role of the court in protecting liberty. The thesis in a nutshell is that the separation of powers horizontally in the federal government and the federal structure vertically through the government had, among other purposes, at their core, a very liberty-protecting purpose. And it was articulated very clearly by numerous of the framers of the Constitution that one of the points of breaking down power horizontally and vertically, we usually only think about it horizontally, but I think it's equally true vertically, was to limit the ability of government to exceed its powers and to exceed the powers and the rights of individuals. And by failing the courts, by failing to assert both separation of powers, but more importantly, federalism requirements and the requirements of the enumerated powers of Article 1, Section 8, have made a huge breach in what was intended to be a constitutional protection of individual liberty, quite apart from the express protections of individual liberty in the Bill of Rights. Well, then finally, of course, the Bill of Rights is a definer of federal judicial power by saying, here's things that the government can and can't do. And we should remind ourselves, there is a Tenth Amendment, which quite expressly says that there are other, that there are powers that are retained by the states, as also is there a Ninth Amendment, which says there are rights other than those that are enumerated. Okay, so that's the constitutional foundation. That's not news to any of you. I sort of mentioned that by way of reminder and to let you know where I'm coming from on those issues. So, in light of that, what's the role of the federal judge in deciding the cases that come before them? Well, as I said when I started, I don't know of any federal judge, at least, who claims to be a judicial activist. William O. Douglas might have certainly behaved that way and was sort of flaunted his judicial activism by, at least in some standing cases, saying, you know, we don't have enough to do, so we don't need to have demanding standing standards. And the best way, I think, to illustrate that is if you go back and read the opinions in the Griswold against Connecticut case, which remembers the contraceptive case, which really formed the foundation for the right of privacy, which underpins all the abortion cases and other claims, sort of privacy claims. And if you read every opinion in that decision, and there are five, they all, in one way or another, make a point of saying that they are not judicial activists, while accusing, at least the dissent, the majority of concurring opinions of being judicial activists. And the rationale that is usually given for why courts shouldn't be judicial activists, and it's sort of the litany of reasons that former Attorney General Ed Meese has articulated many, many times in many, many settings, I would suggest are these. One is that judicial activism is undemocratic. Well, it depends a lot, as I suggested, on what we mean by judicial activism. But there is an argument that says when the courts exceed their constitutional role, they are acting in an undemocratic way because they are, after all, undemocratic institutions themselves. Much has been written about that. It's often described as the counter-majoritarian difficulty of judicial review. Alexander Bickel came to the defense of that in his book, The Least Dangerous Branch, now 25, 30 years ago. But it's an argument about what's the appropriate role of an appointed, life-tenured judiciary in a democratic system. And when the courts exceed their power, they behave undemocratically. Secondly, it's often argued that judicial activism is simply unconstitutional, that is, it exceeds the power authorized under Article 3 for the courts. Thirdly, at least when conservatives were, and that in which camp I include Ed Meese, obviously, they would argue that it would be unprincipled of them to appoint conservative judges who would then be expected to go onto the court and sort of remake the law in their image when they had been for so long critical of what they called activist judges from the Warren Court era. So that they had taken a sort of a principled stand during the Warren Court years against judicial activism. Now they can't appoint the people with whom they agree or who agree with them and expect them to go and sort of undo all of that because that would be an unprincipled and inconsistent position compared to where they'd been before. And finally, Meese and others often argued that if those who were in control of appointing members of the court presently insist on being activists, that will invite activism by those who follow them. It will sort of have this perpetual judicial activism going from left to right, and therefore the doctrines bouncing back and forth depending on who happens to be in the federal judiciary. Well, let me respond to each of those arguments briefly and then get back to the general position that I've taken. I would say I've talked about this issue with lots of people at different times, and I used to sort of try to make a case for what I call principled judicial activism. I sometimes think that's using the term judicial activism to describe what I'm in favor of is a mistake because it carries so much baggage with it and often leads people to conclude things that aren't intended, at least by me. But as I said at the beginning, what I argue for is having judges, and not just at the kind of federal level, at the state level as well, who see it as one of their central functions to act aggressively in the protection of individual liberties for reasons which I'll explain. Now, if I take those four arguments that I suggested have been made mostly by conservatives for why judicial activism is banned, kind of, as they understand the term, and sort of taking the last first, I would suggest that if Ed Meese's point is that when Ronald Reagan was able to get a lot of conservatives on the courts, and indeed get the majority in many circuits, and on the Supreme Court, that if those people were then to go out and be activists, that would invite subsequent appointees of liberal presidents to be activists. I'd say, you know, don't waste your breath on that. They'll be activists if they choose to be in subsequent years. So you ought to be taking a more principled view of the subject, that is, have something more than a concern about how subsequent judges might behave based on the model that your own judges set. So let me address what I think is a more substantive point, and that's this question about democracy. The argument is, as I said, that it is undemocratic of courts to behave in a sort of activist or aggressive manner because it violates principles of democracy, and it allows courts to override the decisions of democratic entities, whether it's a piece of legislation or indirectly a regulatory provision. Well, we should ask ourselves if that's our rationale for objecting to the judicial overriding of a piece of legislation or statute. Where does democracy fit into this constitutional system of ours? And I would say that most modern Americans, not probably those who are in law school, but sort of the average person who votes in the average election or who enters into talks on the average talk show, maybe those aren't the same people, I'm not sure, sees democracy as sort of the core value of the American Constitution. That is, that democracy is what this Constitution is all about. Well, I just think that's, as a historical matter, wrong. That is not what this Constitution is about, I don't believe. It's about, centrally, two things. It was about liberty, and it was about order. And how do you design a government that provides for the orderly arrangement of social affairs in a way in which liberty can thrive? So it was an acknowledgement that there had to be some constraints on liberty. The objective was to maximize liberty and sustain order. Well, where did democracy fit into that? I think it was, as Martin Diamond in a piece many years ago said, democracy was the least worst approach to government in the minds of the framers. Because they didn't think it was the way every decision ought to be made. But they couldn't come up, and I think no one has sense, with a better form of government consistent with the underlying value of liberty. That is, what democracy does for us is it allows you and me and everybody else who chooses to participate in those decisions which are going to be made public. And the only system that would be absolutely consistent with a libertarian view would be a unanimity system. That is, let's say we are everybody in the society, and if we agree that on every issue that the government's going to undertake, we all agree, then our liberties are being 100% protected. Nobody has to give on anything, but of course that doesn't work in the real world. So we go for 50% plus one, except on a few special issues like amending the Constitution, where we have a supermajority requirement. But what is this? Does the fact that 50% plus one agree on something, do we value that in its own sake? For its own sake, is there any sort of value that says that the fact that 50% plus one agree on something means that any decision they make is a decision that we ought to live with? And I'd say no. And I think the framers would have said that. and indeed the whole constitutional structure. Without the Bill of Rights, the whole constitutional structure was designed, among other things, to constrain the ability of this democracy to invade the rights of individuals. Madison, I'm sure you're all familiar with Federalist Number 10. It's not the only place, but it's the most evident place where in the Federalist Papers this issue was addressed, the concern for the tyranny of the majority. And it wasn't a throwaway sentence, it was a serious concern. It was a recognition based upon the experience that the framers had had in that brief period between the Articles of Confederation and the framing of the Constitution with state governments, which had been very abusive in their legislatures on the rights of individuals. So it was from immediate experience that they saw a need to constrain the powers of government. And they did it, I would suggest, first in the separation of power structure, second in the vertical power separation between the federal governments, the states, and local governments. And lastly, they did it, and it was lastly because it wasn't in the original proposal of the Constitution, but the Bill of Rights, which, as you will surely remember, wasn't part of what was originally proposed. Indeed, it was thanks to the people of this state and a couple of others that we got a Bill of Rights, because they said we won't ratify this Constitution unless Congress, as one of its first actions with this new government, adopts or proposes a Bill of Rights. A great act of political faith, I must say, but Congress followed through and offered us up this list of enumerated rights. So democracy, it seems to me, as much as we all believe in its value, and I certainly believe in it as the best form of government or the least worst form of government, was still a form of government that needed to be constrained. Well, if you accept that, then the role of the courts becomes essential and fundamental in this constitutional system. Because who's going to do it? Who's going to enforce these constraints on the democracy, if not the courts? Certainly the legislature won't do it. They are, after all, the instrument by which this power gets exercised and often abused. The administrative agencies, properly conceived in my world, are responding to what they are ordered to do or authorized to do by the legislature. It really falls, it seems to me, to the courts to enforce both the provisions of the Bill of Rights and the structural limits that the Constitution was designed to impose on the legislative power. And so it seems to me that if the judges don't step forward when they believe either that a provision, that one of the rights protected by the Bill of Rights, and we always have this difficult question of the Ninth Amendment, which says there are these other rights, unless you want to have a debate about the right of privacy, for example, we can talk about that. But they have that package of rights. And there's no reason, it seems to me, that the courts ought to defer when those rights are clearly violated. Nor should the courts defer to the legislative exercise of legislative power when either the federal power has exceeded the enumerated powers of the federal government and thus evaded the powers of the state government. Not because we think that the powers of the state and government are importantly exercised, but because that division is a way of constraining both the states and the federal government and thus protecting the rights of individuals. And similarly with separation of powers within the federal government. Well, if the courts don't do it, there's nobody left to do it. And so it is in that sense that I would argue that the courts ought to be aggressive, if not activist, in protecting individual liberty. And just think about what's at risk if the courts do that. I mean, who's got the power in this constitutional system of ours? We have a current Supreme Court, which is supposed to be a conservative Supreme Court, which is very deferential. Certainly, Scalia, Rehnquist, O'Connor tend to adhere to a doctrine of deference to the legislature, deference to Congress, deference to the administrative agencies under the Chevron doctrine. Well, if you think about it as a power issue, and you have individual rights claims on the one hand, and you've got this immense power of government on the other hand, there's really little argument, seems to me, for deference to that large power when the liberties of individuals are at stake. Because the individual is powerless in reference, in relationship to those larger powers. The individual has nothing, if not the courts, to intervene on their behalf. Now, that is not an argument that courts ought to be deferential in every respect to what the legislature does. When Congress, taking Congress, is acting within its powers, when it is, let's say, regulating post offices and post roads, that's a fairly non-controversial area. Absolutely, the courts should not intervene. It's clear that those powers rest with Congress. And it's ought to be none of the business of the courts, unless in the building of a post office, let's say, the government wants to build it on your property and not compensate you for it. In that circumstance, it seems to me the courts ought to intervene and say, can't do it until you pay for that piece of land. Now you can proceed, because that's the constitutional way to do it. But if it's the Congress making some decision about whether we ought to have a post office monopoly, or we ought to have a competitive post office system, or whether the post office system ought to have rural free delivery, or whether people who live in the country ought to have to come into town to pick up their mail, those are all issues that the courts ought to have nothing whatsoever to say about. Their only question is, does it fall within the power of the federal Congress, the legislative power? If it does, the courts should not be second-guessing how the Congress goes about implementing those powers. Now, if we were to shift from post office and post roads, which nobody cares about, to Commerce Clause, which is the source of all manner of federal power, the problem gets more complicated, because we have to resolve this intractable question of what is interstate commerce. And we can resolve it, as the Supreme Court has since the New Deal, in a way that says that interstate commerce is everything. But when the courts do that, they really abandon the whole federal structure as protection of individual liberties. So the division that I draw, and I think that this doesn't, if you take the sort of stock liberal position on judicial activism and the stock conservative position as represented, let's say, by Ed Meese, I think they both have got it wrong, in the sense that the stock liberal position is that the courts ought to aggressively go out and protect what I will describe just as a shorthand as sort of ACLU kind of liberties. And conservatives will get on their high horse about what I will describe as economic liberties, contract rights, property rights. But both of them will be, it seems, perfectly happy for the for other liberties, depending on where they fall along that spectrum, to be interfered with. And at the same time, liberals will be very deferential, or expect the courts to be very deferential, on some matters of legislation, which they agree with, and conservatives, vice versa. Neither of those seem to me to be very principled positions, and what I'm suggesting to you is a different, at least, principled position, which is when individual liberty is at stake, and one can make a plausible individual liberty claim, the courts ought to be very deferential to the individual in that case, because the individual really has no power in this system in relationship to the government. On the other hand, where it is clear that government is acting within their legitimate realm, the courts ought to be totally deferential to the legislature, because that, or the agencies, because those are the areas within which democracy is supposed to function. But I don't think there's anybody who would agree that the democracy ought to decide everything, which is what the sort of total deference position ends up saying. None of us will agree that the democracy ought to decide what we do in the privacy of our homes. Well, there are some who want to regulate certain sexual behavior and certain magazines we might read. But for the most part, I suspect that Americans across the political spectrum say stay out of people's homes, or at least their bedroom. So everybody agrees that there are some things about which the democracy has no say. And I'm just suggesting that that realm about which the democracy has no say was intended by the framers to be much bigger And it was also intended by the framers, to the extent that democracy was to have some say about it, to be split up among different democratic entities along this federalism spectrum, with the expectation that we would have less exercise of governmental power because there'd be competition for that power. And in a federal system, we'd have a whole lot of different sets of rules in 50 different states based upon the different political makeup of those states. So the argument is really that both liberals and conservatives, as traditionally viewed, have not, in my judgment, had a very principled position on this question of judicial activism. They really had a very political position, which isn't surprising, I mean, that's the way people tend to behave. And then what conservatives ought to do, if it's conservatives who are in the position of entering into the court system, they ought to be principled on the question of individual liberties and be as aggressively protective of First Amendment claims, criminal procedure claims, as they tend to be on property rights claims or economic liberties claims. And if they take that sort of principled stance, that liberal judges will be inclined to do the same. So I'll stop with that and welcome any disagreement or debate or questions.
You said earlier that there might be times when Congress can enact a law, and in those instances, the judges and the judiciary should stay out of making the law. But wouldn't it be more economically feasible, from a law and economics perspective, as Judge Richard Posner argues, if the judge, when he had the case in front of him, just went along and made the law, and the Congress disagreed with it, the Congress made a law overruling the judge's law?
Well, I had the good fortune, I guess it was good fortune, of having taken a couple of classes from Judge Posner back before his judge days. And as much as I admire him, his intellect, which is sort of overwhelming, I just think he's wrong about the extent to which he would apply the efficiency standard to the actions of the judiciary. And let me try to illustrate why. I think it's a plausible argument to say, if the judge comes upon a set of rules which leads to an inefficient result, they ought to change the rules, reassign the liabilities or whatever is at issue in a way that yields an efficient result. And then if the legislature or Congress doesn't like it, they can fix it. But I think the reality is that Congress doesn't fix very much. That is, when the courts do things, they get left that way for a long period of time. Let me just give you one illustration, which is an area of law that I've been very interested in for years, and that's wetlands regulation. I don't know how much you know about wetlands regulation, but it's at least as important in this part of the world as in my part of the world. What's the legislative authority for wetlands protection? It's Section 404 of the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, and it is the successor statute to the Rivers and Harbors Act of 1898, I think it is. And its whole purpose is to limit the dredging and filling of the navigable waters of the United States. Now, when that thing was adopted, there was no question what its purpose was. It was to keep people from dumping stuff into rivers like the Hudson, or from building obstructions into that river in the form of docks, piers, and so forth, without getting a permit from the Army Corps of Engineers. And it was all designed to make the rivers, to keep, sustain the navigability of these rivers. Somehow, and that's basically the language that was adopted in Section 404, somehow we got from there to regulating wetlands in the middle of Nebraska, which are these little sunken areas out in the prairie there that fill up with water. Now, how did that happen? Well, I think it happened because the administrative agency really sort of took the lead, but also a lot of judicial cases were brought, mostly by environmental groups, saying that this was, that when somebody proposed to dredge or fill one of these wetlands in the middle of Nebraska, it was a violation of Section 404 of the Clean Air Act, to which the court said, yeah, that looks like the right answer. And to which Congress has done nothing. Now, some might say, well, the fact that Congress has done nothing means that Congress has embraced what the courts have done. And maybe if one takes a poll of Americans, they will say we all favor wetlands protection, although I doubt if they all understand the scope of the wetlands regulatory system. impact. So I guess my long-winded response to your point is that if you, that saying that the courts can do something and then the Congress can fix it if the Congress doesn't like it, the likelihood is that Congress won't fix it. It's a very intransigent institution. It's hard for it to get it to do much of anything. We're trying to reform the Internal Revenue Service now for at least this session of Congress, and who knows where that will go. Any number of other issues. So to me, the what's anathema about Judge Posner's approach is that it's really a utilitarian calculus that pays no heed whatsoever to individual liberty. It says, if the result is, let's say the rule of law is quite clear that I'm liable and you can recover, but in the efficiency calculus, it looks like it'd be better if you couldn't recover and I wasn't liable, so the judge will just change the rule because the net social welfare will be better as a result. That's the calculus. It's willing to be done at the expense of what was clearly defined relationship in terms of rights between you and me. So I think if one believes in the value of individual liberty, one has to have a lot of discomfort with the Posnerian utilitarian calculus in decided cases. Yeah.
Under your view that the court should be active in protecting the individual liberties, can't this then be taken, the concept of individual liberties can be taken to too far an extent by certain judges? For example, last week there was a federal judge striking down the California law, which would have barred benefits to illegal immigrants. So wouldn't that also be speaking about individual liberties of these illegal immigrants? Would you believe that that's taken too far? Is that within what the court should be doing?
Well, of course, behind my position is we have to have some way of knowing what the legitimate scope of these liberties is. What liberties do people have? And do what are the rights of illegal immigrants? What rights do they have, don't they have? And those are all difficult questions, that's right. And I don't claim that it's going to be easy to know what those liberties are. But my case is really that the default position ought to be to favor the individual liberties claim, as opposed to the default position being favor the decision of the democracy. Because I think that the history suggests to me that the democracy will quite willingly tread upon your rights and my rights and the rights of illegal aliens if given the opportunity. It's a sort of a vast redistributive machine absent those individual liberty constraints. So I see very little social cost in the courts being deferential to individual liberties claims. Because usually there are ways in which Congress can achieve, or the legislature at the state level, can achieve its objectives without that invasion of individual liberty. It may cost a little more. In the area of individual liberties work that I've done the most work in, both as a scholar and in some legal cases, is with respect to the takings clause of the Fifth Amendment. And that's, in a way, although it's one of those protections of the Constitution that has been least enforced by the courts, it is, in a way, the easiest one for the courts to enforce because it has an easy solution, which is compensation. That is, in every case, government can go ahead and do what it wants to do. It just has to pay. Now that's a much simpler problem where the power, where the legislative purpose confronts a rights claim than, say, a free speech case where it may be that the government simply can't do what it wants to do if one's aggressive about enforcing rights of individuals. I think one of the biggest, one of the worst developments in American constitutional law in the 25 years that I've been teaching constitutional law is the development of balancing tests. When I started teaching constitutional law a long time ago, it was a much easier subject to teach because there were some answers, in a sense, better answers than there are now. I mean, now, I fully understand why students who take criminal law get frustrated with it, because it's sort of all these three-part tests which end with a balancing. Well, to me, a balancing test means that the court, these are balancing tests that courts are going to enforce, that the court has made itself the legislator. As soon as the court starts engaging in balancing, it's making an assessment of whether what the state is trying to achieve is more or less important than what this individual rights claim is about. And that, to me, means that the court, that is the kind of activism in which I think courts ought not to engage, and yet we've got the whole constitutional structure now has become, in almost every case, one of balancing. And it's a direction which we continue to pursue. It seems to me once you tell the judge that the way the judge is to decide a case is by balancing one thing against the other, this isn't the rule of law anymore. This is the judge as legislator deciding what's more important. And that was, I thought, supposed to have been decided by the Constitution, where it is decided constitutionally, or by the legislature when decided by the
Constitution. You have said that the right should take a stand on individual liberties in the area of criminal law. But I think that the legislators most definitely see personal benefit in being tough on crime. So, I mean, isn't what you admonish the right to do something that they'll never accept?
The right will never accept?
Right. The right will never accept to accord individuals liberty in the area of criminal law.
Well, you may be right. I mean, I'm an academic, you know, so we deal in the world of wishful thinking sometimes. I mean, I'm sort of a believer that if you can get people to sit down and think through the logic of their position, you can change some points of view. It'd be equally hard, I suppose, to get some liberals, many of whom I know well and are on my faculty in my law school, to get them to say that the takings clause ought to be aggressively enforced by the courts, because they see the aggressive enforcement of the takings clause as a real obstacle to achieving a lot of the regulatory objectives that they want to achieve. So, as a political matter, I think it's very hard to get there. But the nice thing about our judicial system is all you got to do is persuade the people who are on the courts, who have these nice life tenure jobs and can't be thrown out, except for really bad behavior. They're really the ones who have to be persuaded to pursue this approach to judging. I will say that I've had an opportunity to talk to a lot of federal judges at a couple of courses that I participate in, federal judges, and they generally are not very accepting of this position. That is, they're very deeply ingrained in the judicial restraint philosophy, which I think is not the right judicial restraint philosophy. That is, it's defer to the legislature even when individual liberties are being impacted. And it's partly because of the utilitarian sort of calculus. It's a willingness to sacrifice the acknowledged rights of individuals to the better welfare of the community. And I view our Constitution as one which said we're not going to compromise the rights of individuals within a fairly clearly defined set of parameters. Just to say that individuals can do whatever they want. The whole liberty system, as Holmes said, is a liberty in which everyone has equal liberty, which means there's a lot of constraint. You know, my liberty is constrained by your liberty and vice versa. So it's not this sort of unconstrained individualism that we often hear mentioned by people who see the agenda of the libertarians as sort of an impractical agenda. But I agree with you. I think that the politics getting there are virtually impossible, because the whole political machinery is one in which wealth gets redistributed. I mean, what I see is violations of liberty are basically for the objective of redistributing wealth in one form or another. That's sort of the point of it. So that, you know, people want to regulate how a property owner uses their land in order to protect wetlands, they'd much rather do it without paying for it. We'd all rather do it without paying for it. But I don't think that's the constitutional way. And I think we're, in that particular area, the takings area, there's been some modest improvements with the Dolan against Tiger case, the Lucas case in South Carolina, and several cases in the Federal Circuit. Court of Appeals to move that law back in the right direction.
Roger.
Okay.
Good.